working with Tony Cordesman. He's also the managing director of the National Security Assessment Project, and he's also a private advisor on security and energy issues for Prince Turkey, the ambassador to the U.S. Nawaf has done a number of kind of Saudi-related security and energy supply studies while he was here at CSIS. We continue to remain in close contact. So when he was in town, we thought we'd avail ourselves of the opportunity to bring him by and just talk about Saudi supply and how we're going to ramp up. He also has an additional publication that we didn't have time to copy, but it's a security assessment of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, which we'll post on our website, and we'll make it available for you probably tomorrow morning, if not this afternoon. A lot of these people you know. If you'd like, we can go quickly around the room just so you know who's in the audience, if that's okay, if that'll help. We'll start.
Nat Kern.
I don't know. I didn't think so.
Jack Riggs, the ask.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again. Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Bob, for having invited me today. This is part of the project that we began 3 years ago under the assessment project to be able to do independent analysis as much as possible on various issues that directly impact Saudi national security. And obviously one of them is energy, which is one of the most critical issues that Saudi Arabia has, and hence we do the constant updates. And one of the programs that we've been doing is to be closely studying and analyzing the ongoing Saudi upstream expansion project that's begun several years ago. So while doing that, I'll take you quickly through the slides, and then I'll try to keep them as brief as possible so that I can take as much questions as possible after the presentation. This is a loose term that I came up with, which is basically to try to put together all the different policies and initiatives that the kingdom has been doing over the last several years, and more specific over the last 6 months in light of what we have been seeing in the region. So the Saudi Strategic Energy Initiative, first and foremost, is to really drive home the point that Saudi foreign policy and Saudi energy policy, or Saudi oil policy more specifically, are completely separate in the mind of the leadership right now. That in no way would the Saudi leadership use its oil policy in any way to impact directly on foreign policy. And the best case example with most recently in Lebanon, where there was obviously a lot of differences and divergence between the U.S. administration and Saudi Arabia on the ongoing conflict on Lebanon during the summer, and the fact that oil was not used or not even thought of as being used as a potential weapon. The other major concern that we have been seeing are what we term the countries of concern in the areas that could have a sizable impact on the price of oil and on the rate of supply. And more specifically, the four major ones are Iran, Venezuela, Nigeria, and Iraq. And these are pretty much straightforward, and they all have their respective reasons why we see them as potential threats. Hence, what has happened is that we've gone through initially what was the phase one of our upstream program, which is basically to take Saudi Arabia's upstream sustained production from its current levels of 11.3 to the 12.5 sustained capacity by mid-year of 2009. And then phase two is to guarantee that the 12.5 will be sustained, and potentially to increase some small incremental increase on that depending on what fields come on stream and at what time. But the important issue here, and that what we'll see in a bit, is the fact of the spare capacity, which we see at the bottom, which is obviously one of the most precious weapon, if you want, in the oil market that a country can have in order to be the ultimate guarantor of stable prices. And this also puts us into the position of being able to mitigate any potential supply cut from one of the four countries that were originally mentioned earlier on. And the interest would be, well, the idea would be to have at least enough spare capacity to be able to offset one of the other four major OPEC countries, and in the hope by 2009 and ongoing to be able to offset most of a second of the major OPEC countries, especially seeing how they've been acting, what kind of speeches have been coming out of their respective leaders, some use, you know, claiming for the threat of using oil weapon against the U.S., domestic instability in Nigeria, and that we'll see in a bit. The numbers here are obviously ballpark numbers or averages, considering the latest cut in Saudi Arabia that was administered several weeks ago, and this is pretty much the ballpark figures of where Saudi oil data is at present. This is just a quick graph to give an idea of how much bigger Saudi Arabia is of the rest of the four other major OPEC countries, and to give a sense of where their exports lie and how much spare capacity Saudi Arabia has potentially in order to mitigate and in some cases to be able to take over most of the supplies of any of the of potential disruptions in one of the four countries. Here we see what the projection that we did and took us some several weeks to do to be able to assess through 2010 where we see the production capacity of the other respective countries being. And where we see quite alarms, for example, in Iran, where we see that due to this serious lack of funds coming into that to the Iranian treasury, specifically in context of all the expenditures that they have to do domestically, we actually see a small decline in their overall sustained production capacity over the next several years. There's a lot of viable information out there to suggest that it's already happening, and one of the best indications is the fact that Iranians cannot meet their respective OPEC quotas today. Nigeria is a different scenario where we see a sustained, there's been some considerable increase in upstream production capacity, yet it's all shut in because of the domestic concerns that is ongoing in Nigeria today. Again, Venezuela is a wild card depending on what Chavez does, how long he'll stay in power. And then Iraq, which is the big question mark, and we have a ballpark at 2 million, but that might be a bit more at any time. But this, we can't really have any real sizable estimates of what will happen in Iraq. But overall, this is the picture we have, and hence why it's so critical for the Saudi government to speed up its upstream production capacities. Hence, this is what forms the core of the upstream Saudi production program up to 2009. And here we've done the updated numbers that were given recently, were able to get recently, and it shows year by year the field name and how much of new increment will be coming on stream with potential estimated deadlines. Now, it's important to know that these deadlines are what we estimate at the assessment project as being feasible deadlines for when the fields will come on stream, and they are all about half a year ahead of schedule from the initial schedule that Aramco has planned for. So if they do go over these deadlines, it won't be technically an Aramco fault. It'll be our misjudgment. So we have the next big incremental that we at present believe will bring Saudi spare capacity to over 3 million barrels a day will be the Khursaniya Arab Light increment that will be coming on. Now we're hoping by the first quarter to the mid of next year. And then the largest project ever to be undertaken by Saudi Aramco is the Khurais, the 1.2, which will be the mega project, and that will bring the huge incremental increase of 1.2 million barrels a day. So this is a ballpark figure of where we see Saudi's sustained production capacity being by the summer of 2009. Here I've tried to break up the fields a bit more and to give a bit more details about the cost associated with the projects in the respective fields. We have, for example, I've used Abu Safa and Hara to give an example how much it cost and to say that both these fields came on stream ahead of the initial planned schedule. And so if we use this as a barometer of success, we believe that Khursaniya and the others could come on sizably ahead of schedule. For example, Khursaniya is already scheduled for December 2007, and we have them coming on at present at least 6 months ahead of schedule. And then we go on to Sheba, which will be bringing on a nice increment by 2008, hopefully now, and then finally the big increment and the costs, if you can see at Khuraiz, which conservatively we estimated between $8 to $9 billion, and which could easily go way over $10 billion by the actual end of the project. And this is, a lot of it is associated with the fact that they're being expedited to be able to bring on these projects well ahead of schedule, especially in context of what's going on in the region today. This is quite new. This has really been a thinking that's been around for the last several months. And 2 weeks ago, the final initial signatures for the big heavy Arab heavy increment at Manif of 900,000 barrels have been signed with American companies to start the initial designs on the project at Manifa. And that will be bringing on 900,000 barrels. Now, the figure I have here is a very rough figure of what you can expect Saudi capacity to be by 2011, up to 13.4. But it's important to note that this can only happen if the other projects happen. It will be very important to note that most of Manifa will be going into replenishing the natural decline cycle in the fields. So this is important to note, that this is not just pure sustained increases, but a lot of it will be going into basically into making up for the lost potential at the older Saudi fields. Again, here I try to give a bit more information. And again, Manifa, if you see the cost of that project, 6 to 7, we estimate it could easily go above $9 to $10 billion again, just to bring that field online by the hopeful date of 2011. At the same time, parallel to what we've seen on the upstream side, Saudi Aramco has now embarked on a massive downstream operation, especially driven by the fact that there's such a bottleneck of refining capacity in the global industry today. And this is centered basically on expanding its refining capacity in North America, which is centered around the Motiva alliance they have with Shell, and expanding that huge refinery in Texas, and building and commissioning, which they've already done, the two domestic refineries in Saudi Arabia, one on East Coast, and then the three hopeful ones of two of which are in China, and there is advanced negotiations for the expansion of these two refineries. This is more specifically where this is at. All the three local ones, the three last bullet points, are the ones that already have been commissioned and signed, and the financing details are being worked out now with the respective actors in this. You'll see the two export refineries at the bottom. One on the East Coast and one on the West Coast of the Kingdom, for the markets, one for Europe and North America, and the other one for Asia. And then there's a huge one with Sumitomo, which is initial cost is coming in at $9.8 billion, and that could go quite sizably, be a bit larger, including a petrochemical plant and expansion of the refinery there, and other industrial projects. Now, getting more into the details of the issue, in the last several weeks, you know, as the tension has been increasing in the Persian Gulf region, especially between the U.S. and Iran, there's been this concern that what would happen if, for example, there is suddenly an outbreak of conflict between the two states, what would happen to the Persian Gulf, and more specifically to the Strait of Hormuz. So what we've done is that we're currently doing this, again, another assessment of how viable it would be to start to thinking about how much Saudi crude could be transported via pipeline from the eastern part of the kingdom to the western part, and making them go out through the Red Sea in order to decrease the importance of Ras Tanura on the overall export of Saudi crude to the world. So these are just numbers, of which around... It shows how important this area is, that two-thirds of Saudi oil is stabilized at the Upcake processing facility, and the remaining at Ras Tanura, both on the Persian Gulf, and that, more critically, that three-quarters of Saudi oil exported through the Ras Tanura, Ras Al-Jamal marine terminals on the East Coast, while the remaining one-fourth is exported through Yanbu, and which we believe that's actually a bit less, because most of that pipeline, which is the Petroline, is being used to feed into the refining and desalination industrial project on the west coast of Saudi Arabia. So So this pipeline would be basically would be based on the Petroline, the current huge pipeline that that traverses Saudi Arabia, and which has now an estimated capacity of around 5.2 million barrels per day. It's obviously being underused, and most of the production, which I think around 1.5 around this area, is actually being sent over to just to being to being used for domestic purposes in powering the power plants, the desalination plants, and the refineries in Riyadh and in the West Coast. So the idea here, the initial idea, would be to expand that petroline using all kinds of new technologies and chemicals to be able to expand the potential, the throughput of crude in that pipeline, and with an idea to build a smaller parallel one that would end up in Rabigh, which is now center to the new $30 billion new King Abdullah City, which would be able to at least have a total capacity of both pipelines of around 10 million barrels per day in order to be able to be a crisis contingency in case the Strait of Hormuz is closed for any potential reasons. We're currently going over the cost issues, and surprisingly enough, the costs are not expected to be as high as we initially thought they would be, but it's still a project in doing. Then I wanted to give you some more sense about how the Saudi oil fields are being managed, and about and where there's been a lot of talk about, you know, water cuts and the actual technical data coming out of these fields. And it's quite interesting because as much as there's been talk about it, Aramco using a lot of the techniques that were the basis of the existence of Aramco from its American founding sisters, the Four Sisters, have been quite impressive in how they've been able to manage and streamline the Saudi oil field management. So we have now a ballpark figure of around, on average, 29% throughout all these fields, but that varies from the older fields such as Abqaiq to the newer ones such as Sheba. And a big concentration of this centers around Ghawar, because Ghawar is obviously the world's largest oil field and really the base of Saudi Arabia's production capacity. And fortunately enough, we've been seeing a small decline in the water cut levels in Ghawar over the last several years from approximately 35% to just under 32 in 2005, which is quite encouraging, seeing how old the Ghawar production life cycle has been, and how critical it still is to Saudi production numbers. On the issue of Saudi oil field depletion rates, that's also been a big issue of questions and thinking about what is the level of the very Saudi field depletion rates. Of course, by far the field that's been depleted the most is obviously the oldest one, which in this case would be Abqaiq, which is around practically depleted if you see the numbers here, and then Ghawar, which is just under half of its original estimated in-house reserves, being just under 50%. And then we have the newer fields such as Sheba, which is one of the shining examples of Aramco's expansion programs, just coming in at just around 95% of still of its initial estimated proven reserves still being intact. The importance here, and this was in a way a very important technique that I guess a lot of people miss, and which I was not aware of until the actual Aramco engineers explained it to me, was this whole technique of maintained potential. And it's important to note because a lot of the budget that Saudi Aramco gets from its direct sales of oil actually goes to maintaining the Saudi fields. And this maintained potential drilling, it makes up for what would be a theoretical or in this case, excuse me, hypothetical decline rate of 8% if none of that money was being used to manage the fields and to be able to reinvest and to do the necessary management techniques. And this is exactly our concerns when we see other countries, for example, in Russia, where the kind of money that Aramco is plowing back into these fields is not happening. And so Russia is an example, Iran is an example, and Venezuela is another example. And here we're talking about several billion dollars a year just going into being able to maintain at least a production level of Saudi Aramco in times where there is not that upstream program happening. So close around 2005, the actually real depletion rate of the Saudi field comes much closer to the 2% mark that I have here. In some years, it's a bit higher depending on where the production level is. But as it's a given, it would be logic that a lot of this is well below the industry average, especially dealing with the countries that have similar production production problems and production rates as Saudi Arabia. In this case, Russia would be the best example to take in comparison. So I just wanted to give you a quick snapshot of where the Saudi upstream and downstream programs are going, and I hope I've been fast enough in order to be able to give you as much time as possible so that we can discuss and I can try to answer as many of your questions as you have. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Let me ask you just a couple of main questions. On the 8%, it just strikes me, even with the new increments, the proposal of being, you know, adding 2.3 to get 1.5 net, that's 800,000 barrel difference. When you're producing about 10 million barrels a day, that's 8%. So I'm not sure how this the 2% figures in. But I guess my real question is related to is the increase in production of especially heavy quality related. Is that related or tied in at all to refining construction around the world being able to handle that? Because you recall in times that Saudi Arabia put extra heavy on the market when refining capacity was tight and light premium products is what people wanted, there were no buyers for the heavier oil. So is that tied to either the China projects or the Motiva upgrade or expansion of international refining capacity?
Just to your figures, these 2%, that figure is not on is what Saudi Aramco is producing every year. So it's far, it's obviously. It's not the 10 million. I mean, there is, last year we were at 9.1, this year it's going to be substantially lower. So it's not a production, it's actually real production capacity, and then they do a ballpark average of where they, of how much they believe they've actually lost in that year, depending on the production level.
Okay.
Yeah. On the question of your heavy crude,
When you start bringing on fields that are heavy and there's timetables on it, if there's no buyers in the world for heavy crudes, is it more tied to additional conversion capacity in refineries or specific projects like Motiva upgrades or the China upgrades, or is that going to be distressed oil that will be available but probably won't have buyers in a market where people want lighter oil?
Well, if you see the initial increases is all going to be
light.
Yeah, they're all light, and Manifa comes on stream once Jubail or Yumba come on stream too.
Okay, so it's tied.
It's definitely tied. I mean, it was very smartly done to bring in the heavy with the excess refining capacity on stream. Yes,
on the China side too.
Absolutely,
way of dedicating heavier crudes to a market where you have a lock-in buyer. Okay.
Frank, do we have any constraints on what we've seen and heard today? Any constraints on the record, off the record, what have you?
This is on the record.
Oh, it's up to you. Yeah, it's on the record. Yeah.
It's on the record. Will that change your question?
The expansion is quite impressive. At the same time, we now have a situation where basically only Saudi, with some help from Kuwait and Emirates, are willing to cut production to stabilize the market. The rest either does nothing, or they do it from make-believe numbers, not from real numbers. OPEC's internal studies and some IEA studies suggest this may remain like this until maybe the end of the decade. The demand for OPEC oil may not grow very much. So that means that Saudi is making massive expenditures to really get some control back over that market. At a time when the major consumers are saying, we want to reduce our dependence, not on oil, but on Middle East oil. How is that perceived in Saudi when you're making all these enormous commitments, when your major partners are telling you, well, what we really like to do is buy less from you?
Initially, the statement by President Bush was obviously met with a lot of surprise. But just realistically on the ground, we don't think that this is possible. And, you know, as time has passed, you know, there is a movement that believes that, you know, maybe he just did this for, obviously, for domestic political consumption at the time, and that, you know, that he most probably didn't himself believe it, that it could be remotely possible, since all the major CEOs of all the big American companies came out. For example, Chevron, Texaco, he was in Jeddah attending the Jeddah Economic Forum at the time of that speech, and he came out and basically ridiculed it. So, and for us, it was kind of you know, surprising coming from the vice chairman of such a big, such an amazing oil firm. So we don't really put a lot of attach a lot of importance to statements like this because fundamentally they're realistically not possible.
Mike, sort of answered my question, but basically your expansion is not to put it on the market, but it is to be prepared in case the other countries reduce their production. So you're just building spare capacity for now.
Well, I mean, this is one way you can look at it, but at the same time, there is the feel that, let's say, there is another crisis, you know, technical, such as the one we've been seeing with the refining, or another war, such as we just saw in Iraq, or something else. And the issue is, what will Saudi Arabia do? Because Saudi Arabia was called upon this time to act, and it, in a way, couldn't really act as much as it wanted to because of the fact that there was a huge refining bottleneck, limited capacity. So the Saudi leadership doesn't want to find itself in the same position as it found itself this time by being always the ultimate guarantor of stable prices and this time not being able to act on all what it could have done without the limited capacity it had in the different ways. So this is why. So yes, if you look at it from this perspective, depending on where the oil environment will be at the given time of when all these increments will come on stream, you could expect a higher spare capacity. But I think that it's wise because it reassures the market in such a big way that, well, let's say there's a crisis, the Saudis have over 3 million barrels, what will look like now by the mid of next year, over 3 million barrels of spare capacity that they could bring on at a very short notice.
Mark.
Sorry.
Not to put you on the spot, but I will anyway.
Thank you.
What do you mean by the correct price?
Correct.
$50 a barrel, $60 a barrel, $20 a barrel. Not to put you on.
I mean, I obviously don't know what the correct price is,
yeah, right. Correct
but let's say that from our own private estimates, we believe that if the price of our barrel is anywhere between, the limit would be around $35 to $38 per barrel, would be good to sustain all of Saudi Arabia's domestic expansion, social, educational, to keep the foreign assets rising, to pay back the domestic debt, and to keep this new foreign aid programs that King Abdullah has instituted over the last 2 years going. So anywhere between 35 to 38 on the current production levels is where would be the minimum that from a Saudi perspective, from our initial estimates, we believe it would be feasible.
That's Saudi oil, not WTI.
Saudi oil.
What's better than WTI?
Sorry?
If prices stay low, I mean, this idea of production cutbacks builds spare capacity faster. Given the high cost of rigs, steel, equipment, people, what about expansion that doesn't occur on time? I mean, all these other projects have brought in, you know, below budget and ahead of schedule. Does a lower price environment for 6 months make a difference on how fast these projects get developed?
I mean, obviously, let's say that the price suddenly collapses to $20 a barrel, for example. For example, then yes, I mean, I would expect that there will be some serious recalculations. But the way it's being done and how it's been, how it was formatted, and the kind of budget that the Ministry of Finance is making available to Aramco to go through it, and all the planning that's been going on, like 5 years down the line. I doubt that there's going to be any glitches in these fields coming on stream when Aramco said. And if you take it from the history of Aramco bringing on projects at the due date, they've actually brought them on stream ahead of schedule. So if this is a an example of the expertise, you know, the engineers at Aramco have developed in order to bring back big to bring on stream big fields, then we can, you know, then this is a very good indicator. The big challenge, obviously, will be here, will be obviously with this one here with Khuris, which is going to be, you know, it will be the largest by far that Aramco has ever undertaken to bring on stream at any given time. And then they've also now brought working on Manifa. So, I mean, the story here really is to see the amount of pressure and the amount of work ethics that's going into how Aramco is rechanging itself in order to be able to assume all this and to bring them on stream with the level, with actually on such a fast schedule, especially if you compare them to other countries, which are still debating just to bring on stream 500,000 to 600,000 barrels a day.
On the Khuris field, how many wells are you talking about here, roughly?
Oh, I wouldn't have these numbers. I mean, we're talking about a lot of wells, but I wouldn't have the exact numbers on how many
we're
wells.
Talking about 1,000 or 100?
I would say several hundreds, but I wouldn't be able to be specific on that,
yeah,
so don't quote me
okay.
more specific on that.
That's
sure.
Yeah, okay.
Just a minor question. I noticed you had Neutron Zone Heavy being developed. I assume that's offshore.
That would be the one with Chevron, actually.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, that would be the one with Chevron. And there's two projects. There's obviously the offshore one, which you're hoping, and then there is the negotiations with Chevron, because Chevron is actually, as you know, is the one actually developing that field.
Would that include an extension of their present contract?
Well, that's where that's why I put it. Project's not confirmed yet because they're still negotiating the technicalities of if they're going to extend it or not. So hence why this project hasn't moved forward. I have that. Yeah.
When the minister was here this summer and Chevron presented, you know, when we talked, it was a technological series and presentation, and Aramco was adamant about bringing Chevron in to talk about steam drive, which caught a lot of us by surprise because we've been doing steam drive in California forever. But the recovery rate, the factors that they were showing, was from 26% to almost 80%, which is the reason they thought it was significant. So.
And this is actually the new technologies that they want to kind of bring into that field. That's correct, yeah.
I would think so, which is also, just for clarification purposes, you know, when Mr. Juma talked about the 12 million barrel a day and then the minister talked about the 12 and a half, that's where it's the neutral zone.
Yes, that's
so
correct.
The government
talks
in 12 and a half and Aramco talks about 12.
Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, that's been also a question that's been raised. Obviously, when Minister Naimi speaks, he speaks as global Saudi production, so that would be the 12.5. And for Aramco books... And I would suggest that you all see their end-of-year reports because they've become so transparent and so open to the numbers of, you know, they even go to the point of exports in number, production numbers, refined products exports, you know, NGLs exports. They've done a tremendous job in that. For Aramco books, they book all fields that they produce directly and not through another partner, in this case it was Chevron. So that's where there is the difference in calculations.
Is there any concern about manpower being able to bring these projects on?
Yeah, that was an issue, and hence why there's been, you know, this huge employment drive to bring in engineers from practically all over the world and to give them a lot of incentive packages to come. Because obviously, in Saudi Arabia, there's been a sizable shortages of petroleum engineers, of Saudi petroleum engineers. And the ones that are, and the younger generation ones are still doing, they're finishing their studies in the U.S. or abroad on Aramco scholarship. So there's been this strive to pay a premium, you know, for human resources, as well as for rigs and for other critically needed materials. So that's where, I guess, where we talk about budget estimates, all this will have to go up because they've been, you know, paying all these premiums to get everything in place to be able to meet these deadlines.
Yeah, the American companies are finding it in pipeline welders. It's not just engineers. When Nansen Soleri, the chief reservoir engineer from Aramco, was here last year, he said he was down in Texas interviewing engineers to come to Saudi Arabia. And he asked them if they had concerns about security in Saudi Arabia going. And he was telling us this anecdotal, but stories of folks coming out of Colombia and Venezuela said, we don't have any security problems in Saudi Arabia. We're coming out of Venezuela and Colombia.
That's good. Nawaf, you and Frank mentioned that the minister always has a capacity number that's 500,000 barrels a day higher than Juma. And you said that was the neutral zone. I think their share of the neutral zone is about 260. Have you ever discovered where the other 240,000 barrel difference is coming from?
No, these are...
It's just due to rounding?
No.
Just double that.
These are, if you go... That's excellent. Only not with these questions. What we have is... This is the estimated... So what what they've done in the oil ministry, to my understanding, is that they have an open range of around 250,000 that they keep to where Saudi production could land, because it all has to ultimately depend on the decline rate at this given year, depending on where the capacity will be. And so we have an average, a high average of around 800,000 barrels, depending on a high capacity base. So this is what I've understood they think about when there's
a difference between actual production and production that could be brought on within 60 days or 90 days.
Yeah, 60 to 90 days.
It's almost double, yeah. I think that's what the difference is.
But the actual production has always been lower than capacity.
But with the new recovery rate, you can bring on surge capacity, yeah, quickly.
So you say it's surge, you say it's decline.
No. The neutral zone, the difference between the 260 and the 500 for the neutral zone is production versus capacity.
The neutral zone capacity is that much higher?
The Saudi share of, expanded capacity, surge capacity in the neutral zone on the Saudi portion can be up as high as 400 to 500,000 barrels a day. That I've heard consistently.
It's down now. It's at, we're 260 for this year, 270,
actually,
the Chevron stuff. But we could go up as high as 400 or 450,000.
So Chevron is severely prorated?
No, and ours. I mean, we haven't...
They're the producer.
No, they're the producer on one end of it. Yeah. Aramco is producing the other end of it.
On the
Aramco Gulf operations. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
I had a question. You've got... about 2009 or 12, there's 3 million barrels of spare capacity. And presumably, you're not going to shut in heavy stuff since you're going to do all these new refineries around the heavy crude. So that means that you're going to there's some light crude that isn't going to be produced. I just wonder, is that right? And also, and you got all the spare capacity, but Saudi just said you're not going to be the swing producer anymore. Is that still the case?
I mean,
how's that going to work?
Sure. I don't think the swing capacity thing is really something that we can control. I think we just, by just the natural progression of how we've positioned ourselves in the market, that we're going to, directly or indirectly, keep on being the swing producer. I mean, as much as we didn't want to do, we didn't want to be the major ones that cut in the last cuts, it was basically all of Saudi Arabia that cut. So I don't really think that, even though the policy might have, some people want to change that policy, just by the natural realities in the market, we're not going to be able to have a chance to change that. On the issue of great cuts, I'm not too familiar. This, again, depends on the environment in which the market will be at this time. But the export refineries are there in order to be able to mitigate any potential downsize to it. More specifically, if you look around the world, we don't see any major investments in the refineries in the major countries to be able to supply and to be on the on the balanced level that we hope. So it's a big risk. You're telling me absolutely. It's my understanding that we're still looking to build another two refineries outside of Saudi Arabia. And it's really going to be able to specifically answer your question. I mean, I'm going to have to get into hypothesis. I'm not really good at that because I always get it wrong anyway. So,
could you spend a couple minutes talking about the security report? I mean, just kind of in summary. what Saudi Arabia is doing.
Yeah, on the security, I think I should have put some slides in there, but I didn't have time. It was to talk about what they're doing on the energy security side. And, I mean, as much as there's a lot of money being put into the oil and the upstream, there's also a sizable amount of money that's actually going directly into energy security from the different services that are responsible for it. So in Saudi Arabia, you have the Ministry of Interior, you have the National Guard, and you have the Ministry of Defense that all have a share to do directly with physically securing the oil facilities and the oil installations. And what we've seen, especially after the failed Upcake attack, was that there's been this new system that's being put in place, this new command and control system being put in place under the guidance of the Ministry of Interior to be able to have quick coordinations and crisis management scenarios in case of anything going drastically wrong. So we've had new redundancy put in place. There's been a new offshore security system or security program that's being implemented, especially on the offshore dealing with the big terminals. And this is in coordination between the Navy and the Border Guard. And obviously, there are Aramco people on the inside. And then there's been a huge new reevaluation of the security systems that were in place prior to Upcake. And that deals more specifically with the various services of the Ministry of Interior and what role they have, and then trying to bring in more of the National Guard elements and the Ministry of Defense. This is a whole presentation, I tried to get as much into it in that update, but it would need a whole new presentation by itself to see how complex this whole program is.
Paul,
thank you, Paul Connors, Canadian Embassy. Thank you for your presentation. Supplementary on that, after the failed attack on Abqaiq, the U.S. announced the Global Energy Infrastructure Security Initiative, under which the U.S. would offer security audits of energy infrastructures to certain critical countries, and Saudi Arabia was identified. All this work you just described, was that done in conjunction with American partners, or was it solely a Saudi initiative? I know the Americans have offered this to Saudi Arabia.
No, I mean, this is a very important point. We don't believe that energy security or anything dealing with domestic security should be, audited by any foreign country. Or, it's not an issue of attitude. Just, we perceive it as a sovereign issue. So no, it hasn't. I mean, this has really been done domestically. And again, there was a report out several weeks last week about, British ships having come into Ras Tanura to defend. I mean, that again is completely baseless because there are set procedures of how it's done. And in the Gulf, coalition ships don't enter Saudi waters. And in order to be able to go to Ras Tanura, you have to be in Saudi waters. So that story was kind of funny. But it comes pretty much to your questions. There has been coordination on information, absolutely, and on threat scenarios, but not specifically on having...
But not an audit.
No, of course not, no.
Interior pipelines, yes. In Saudi Arabia, are they buried or are they above ground? Or is it a mix?
No, they're above ground.
They're above ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mark.
Go ahead.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I read a story the other day in the press about Saudi Arabia building a $16 billion electronic fence between itself and Iraq. Is that true?
It's the same contractors we're using
on
the board.
No,
I'm sorry.
I believe you would say this, Frank, but is that true or not?
Yeah, but I don't think it's $16
billion. What? What is it? But, $8
billion? yeah, I mean, they're going to build that fence. But this is part of a bigger project. There's going to be a physical fence, and then there's going to be an electronic shield that will go around around most of the Saudi shores, and that will hopefully be happening in the first quarter of next year. So that's correct.
Electronic shield.
Yeah,
that
electronic shield. No, the electronic shield is part of the bigger package, but the actual fence will happen in the first quarter of next year. They were building that.
Really?
Yeah.
First quarter.
Yeah, it's pretty much like you're building your fence with Mexico.
Oh, that was our favorite. Sorry.
I hope yours might be better.
Yeah, hopefully that's right.
Hopefully
yours
will
be better.
Oh,
yeah.
Your money is settled. Oh, nice. Oliver, go ahead.
I know it's just been a few days, but do you have any assessment of what the feeling is back in Riyadh of the results of the election or the changes?
No, I don't know.
Jennifer, by the way, just handed me a note that Senator Allen had a press conference at 3 o'clock and he conceded. So the Democrats control the Senate. Okay.
Definitely no comment now.
Herman, go ahead.
Now, Nawaf, you gave an excellent presentation earlier last week at the U.S. Arab Council on your views or your group views on Iraq. Perhaps, I don't know if you want to hear, but say something what your perception is as a result of your rather pessimistic views that you expressed on Iraq, what you think is going to happen to Iraq production, say, over the next 5 to 10 years.
I don't know enough about the Iraqi oil industry to be able to comment in any meaningful way, but in a macro level, we do, from our assessment that we've done here, is that we have a very bleak assessment of how Iraq can hold together as a central entity with a central government in place to be able to coordinate a lot of the reconstruction projects that the oil industry is needed to be able to bring it up to, you know, what would naturally be a much higher level, seeing all the riches that Iraq has. Our concern obviously has to do with the southern fields and the northern fields, and these two fields really sit in areas where two distinct communities live in. And from what we've been able to see, that we don't believe at least one of the communities, which is the Kurds, would want to be in a long-term project of having some of being part of some form of a unified Iraq. I mean, I hope we're wrong. I really do hope we're wrong, but this is so far what we've been able to assess from our work we've done over the last 2 years.
Any other thoughts, comments, questions? Sure.
Do your assessments of the expansion future needs of oil match, you heard this morning, I forgot how many barrels a day the world will need by 2030, it was on biofuels, but by and large it still meant that oil usage would expand.
Mm-hmm.
And you're expanding to 3 million barrels a day, and nobody else is expanding. At what point do you anticipate that there will not be an increase in capacity?
I'm not too familiar with what the Aramco corporate planning assessments are on that. But what I see from the other ministries that do similar assessments in Riyadh is that it's by far not enough. And obviously, Saudi Arabia, there will come a limit where Saudi oil fields will not be able to keep on expanding at the rate that we're seeing now. So yes, I mean the quick answer to that would be yes. I mean, by far this is not enough, and we hope that other countries come on stream with sizable new increments. But again, it doesn't seem to be the case anytime soon, and this is a big concern for us.
You know, this is one of the questions, this deferred investment. We had Ambassador Ramsey here from the IEA yesterday. And the short-term versus long-term, short-term focus is that in 2007, non-OPEC supply, if everything comes on, Brazil, the United States comes back, you know, Norway, Russia, the Caspian production increases will match the increase in domestic demand. So then the question is for OPEC producers, one of the reasons that they're constraining back, if you start looking at demand in the first quarter and then in the second quarter where you normally have the dip, if you start to look out 60 or 90 days, if world stocks keep building, you've got a short-term surplus, absent Iran or absent, you know, something happened to Nigeria that makes things worse. Then there's the longer-term piece. If investments aren't made, how quickly you bring on this extra production, because all these charts have per capita growth, you know, going up to between 160 and 125 million barrels a day. And that presents other challenges, infrastructure, environment, security. So I used to do partly corporate planning when I was at Pennzoil, and I was pretty confident on a six-month forecast. And Ed talked the other day about he loves to do forecasts to 2100. Yes. And if I'm wrong, come and see me. So somewhere in between, we have a confidence level that works.
2100 is 9 o'clock.
By some standards. You folks in the UK could never do it, right?
But it's funny, just following on what you said yesterday, was at the Department of Energy giving that similar presentation. And it's interesting to see that the EIA has brought down their forecast on Saudi crude quite sizably.
Well, yeah, but in part because they raised the price threshold, so demand comes down, increased contribution from alternative fuels, And so then the global contribution of Saudi is less. Right. I mean, they turned out almost 9 million barrels a day in the last year.
Yeah, that's right.
Just because of the price.
Right. Non-OPEC supply, if the price went up, so they push non-OPEC supply, if demand down.
So the gap is small.
You're the other residuals.
No.
The gap is small.
Saudi Arabia is the swing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. If there's no other questions, please join me in thanking Nawaf. This is a great presentation. And we'll host both presentations on our website. But thank you.